So I want to cover a bit more supersymmetry today and then start moving on to other topics. But before I start, are there any questions? In any case, recall that we took the standard model and we extended it to a supersymmetric theory by embedding all the standard model fermions and the Higgses into chiral supermultiplets, and by embedding the standard model vector bosons into vector multiplets. And this is the MSSM superpotential. It reproduces the standard model Yukawa couplings. And it's the most general possible form I can write down that's consistent with supersymmetry, gauge invariance, and R parity. So we had to add R parity to get rid of some of the some extra operators that would have been a problem, that would have broken Barry on our lepton number, and they're very strongly constrained observationally. So this is our MSSM superpotential. And at this point, we have a completely supersymmetric theory, and our particles and superpartners have the same masses. And this is no good. This isn't consistent with experiment. So we also have to include soft supersymmetry breaking terms. And the soft supersymmetry breaking terms, again, they should be soft in the sense that I spoke about yesterday. And they should also be gauge invariant, and they should also agree with R parity. And the most general form for these is as follows. So these are these are the scalar mass squareds that I spoke about yesterday. That's an example of a B term. The B is part of the name. And then we have soft mass squareds of this form for all the fermion multiplets. We have A terms. And the form of the A terms is again much like what I had before, where these A terms mirror the superpotential couplings, but now there's a soft operator here, and since I forgot a tilde here, everything in here is a scalar, so this is like a phi cube type operator, and that means the A term has to have mass dimension 1. This has mass dimension 2. B mu has mass dimension 2. And then the last piece I can add is a set of gauge genome masses. And these correspond to the gauge genome superpartners of R. These correspond to the gauge genome superpartners of the gauge bosons. So this is the superpartner of the hypercharged gauge boson. Sometimes we call it the Beano. So if I talk about Beanos, this is what I'm talking about. So it's the Beano. This is the so-called Weno or Weno. And this G is the Gluino. It's the gauge genome of the gluon. So this is the whole MSSM. We have a set of embeddings of all the standard model fields into chiral and vector supermultiplets. We have an MSSM superpotential of this form that includes R parity to get rid of the nasty stuff. We have a corresponding set of soft terms. And if we didn't have R parity, in principle, we could also have other soft terms. So if we didn't have R parity, we could also have terms like, for example, LLE, and we could have had a corresponding A term for LLE in that case. But LLE is odd under R parity, so we don't include it in the soft terms here. And this is the whole story. So you have everything you need to write down and study the full MSSM. And I'm going to go over a few of the most important aspects, but the key thing is that this is essentially the whole story. You have the gauge charges. You have a set of fairly simple supersymmetric interactions. There are also other interactions enforced by supersymmetry. There's the extended gauge interactions that connect through a gauge coupling, a gauge genode to matter multiplets. And you also have a D-term part to the scalar potential. And again, the way to derive those is just to apply to this particular case the general rules we covered earlier. And then the extra piece are the soft terms. And the soft terms is where things get kind of messy. In the sense that if I only had the supersymmetric parts depend on the gauge couplings. And those gauge couplings have to match up with the standard model values. They depend on these Yukawa couplings. And again, these Yukawa couplings match up with the standard model values. And there's some mass term for the Higgs. There's a mass term for the Higgs in the standard model. So the MSSM at the supersymmetric level essentially, or actually, in fact, it has even less parameters than the regular standard model. Because we'll see that the quartic coupling for the Higgs is actually related to the gauge couplings. There's no independent quartic coupling for the Higgs in supersymmetry. The place where things get messy are these soft terms. And the soft terms are, from the point of view of the standard model, a completely new set of parameters. So our MSSM would be really nice and clean and simple and wouldn't really introduce many new parameters beyond the standard model if it was exactly supersymmetric. But we're forced to break supersymmetry softly, and that introduces a whole bunch of new parameters, and that gives a lot of freedom for the structure of the theory. And on the one hand, we need these soft parameters to push up the superpartner masses. On the other hand, the soft parameters are what makes the supersymmetric extensions of the standard model a bit messy. So as a first application of this, let me move this up. Let's move. As a first application of this, let's look at the Higgs potential in the MSSM. So getting the Higgs potential is not quite as direct as in the standard model. In the standard model, you're just given it. In supersymmetry, we have to decode the supersymmetric structure and bring down the total potential. So the total Higgs potential, I'll write it as VH, has two supersymmetric pieces. There's an F-term piece, and there's a D-term piece, and then there's a contribution from the soft terms. And if you take the gauge interactions we have, and the soft terms and the superpotential, it turns out that what you get for this is the following scalar potential. In this case, I'm writing down a scalar potential for the neutral components of the two Higgs multiplets. So let me go through all the parts of this. The first thing is that, I've done a few things at once. The first part is that this theory has lots of scalars. And in principle, I could have written down a scalar potential for all these scalars. But the only scalars I've included here are the neutral components. Oops, sorry, this is a typo. So the only scalars I've written down in this potential are the neutral components of the Higgs up, Higgs down scalar doublets. So first of all, if we look at the other scalars in the theory, things like scalar superpartners of the quarks or leptons, those objects all carry electric charge, for example. And if one of those fields got a VeV, we'd run into problems. We'd run into problems because we would spontaneously break electromagnetism. And we know that we don't spontaneously break electromagnetism. So we have to make sure that none of those fields gets a BEV. And that's typically easy to arrange as long as the soft mass squareds for those scalar, for those fermions are all positive. So we're going to assume that the soft masses for the scalar superpartners, or the, for the fermion superpartners are all positive, so that none of the fermions get masses. Sorry, none of the fermions get BEVs. So it's a phenomenological requirement. The other thing is that now if you only focus on the Higgs part, what we're going to do to generate a BEV is we're going to allow this term to run negative. So we'll come back to this in a second, but ultimately this is the thing that's going to be, we're going to assume is negative, will generate a Higgs BEV. Now, given the structure of the full Higgs potential, I'm only writing the neutral components, but you can show that both by suitable choice of gauge and some fiddling around, that the potential is minimized for a suitable choice of gauge when only the neutral components of the Higgs get BEVs. So again, I'm not showing this explicitly. I have a bit more information in my notes for this. Now, if I look at the terms in here, this piece is a soft term. This mu squared comes from the superpotential, the part of the superpotential that's dw dhu that I square it all. And similarly for hd, this piece is obviously the b, comes from the b mu term up here. And this piece is a combination of the d term potentials for su2 left and u1 hypercharge. So if we look at the terms, we have quadratic term, quadratic term, quadratic term, and quartic term. But now we have two different scalars. And on top of that, the entire quartic term, there's no independent lambda here. The entire quartic term is the strength of the quartic term comes from the gauge couplings. So in this sense, without supersymmetry breaking, the structure of the Higgs BEVs would be, the structure of the Higgs potential would actually be simpler than the standard model. In the standard model, you have an independent lambda coupling, an independent Higgs quartic. Here, we don't have an independent Higgs quartic. One other thing you can see from this potential is that if I didn't have soft supersymmetry breaking, I wouldn't have this term, or this term. And that would imply that the minimum of my potential would actually not break electric symmetry breaking, because I would have positive mass terms for Higgs up squared, Higgs down squared, and that would make my origin stable. And this thing is positive definite. So this thing can never destabilize my potential either. So we also see that in the MSSM, you also need soft supersymmetry breaking to get electric symmetry breaking. And one last thing is that these Higgs up zero and Higgs down zero are complex scalars. Now, we can always choose a gauge, choose a U1 transformation, such that at the minimum of the potential, HU0 is real and positive. So if we choose that gauge where HU0 is real and positive at the minimum of the potential, in principle, we can also assume that this is real and positive by choice of our fill basis. And that means that if this is real and positive, then the lowest possible value of the potential will occur when this is also real and positive. So it turns out that by a nice choice of gauge coordinates plus field redefinitions is that we can assume that HU0, HD0 are both real positive at the minimum. And this makes solving for the potential even easier, because now instead of having a complex object where I have to worry about the real and imaginary components, I can just focus on the real component here, real component here, real component here, and this thing is just going to turn into a 2b mu, Higgs 0 up, Higgs 0 down. One last comment about the potential is that, again, I have a set of quadratic terms here, and I have a quartic term here. And a quartic term comes from a b-term potential, sorry, d-term potential, and this thing, this d-term potential vanishes along a certain direction, corresponding to hu0 is equal to hd0. So on the one hand, to break electric symmetry, we have to make sure that some combination of these things is net negative, so we destabilize the origin. On the other hand, we want to make sure that if we go out along this hu0 equals hd0 direction, that we don't that when this vanishes, all these quadratic pieces should have a net positive coefficient, because if they had a negative coefficient, I would just have I just have an inverted parabola potential, and my potential would be unbounded. I just slide off to infinity. So from this, you can derive two consistency conditions. The first consistency condition is that if I expand around the origin, I should have essentially a negative determinant. So that tells me that my origin is unstable. The second condition you can derive is that if I go out along one of these d directions, the net effective quadratic term has to have a positive coefficient. So that gives me two consistency conditions. I want this. Okay, let me move this up. So that gives me two consistency conditions, and as long as I satisfy those, I'm guaranteed to have both electric symmetry breaking and a potential that's bounded at large field values. Now, in any case, let's call the values of these Higgses at the minimum HU0 and HD0, and we're going to write them in the following way. So we're going to have two independent BEVs, one for Higgs up and one for Higgs down. And the standard way to write them is that the Higgs up is VU, Higgs down is VD. And we can write these as sines and cosines of a common BEV. Now, we're going to see in a second that this BEV, this total BEV, is going to set the value of the W and Z masses. And it should have a value of about 174 GeV. So it just corresponds to what you'd identify as the Higgs BEV in the standard model. Now, my normalization uses 174 GeV. You may have seen 246 GeV. And that just comes down to whether I define this thing relative to this with a root 2 or not. So it's just a matter of convention, and this is the one I happen to use. OK, the other thing is that because HU0 and HD0 are both real and positive, this beta lives somewhere between 0 and pi by 2, just because both are in the first quadrant. So this is my minimum. And in terms of them, I can go off and derive vector boson masses. So for example, the vector boson mass for HD. If I go off and I expand out the covariant derivatives for HU and HD, and I expand these around the minimum, I get vector boson masses. And what I find here is the standard relations. The MW squared is just G squared over 2V squared, and MZ squared is G squared plus G prime squared over 2V squared. So again, you get these in exactly the same way as you would in a standard model. The only difference here is that I'm going to get a contribution to the mass from this piece and a contribution to the mass from this piece. This piece is going to give me a VU squared. This piece will give me a VD squared. And I end up adding them up in this form to get a V squared here. But these masses come out in terms of V in the same way as a standard model masses. And on top of this, we get vector boson masses. We also have we also get a set of physical excitations. So remember that we had complex scalars. And we had four components. So we have four independent complex scalars, which looks like 8 degrees of freedom. But three of these degrees of freedom are going to correspond to Goldstone bosons that are eaten by the W and the Z, so 2 plus 1. And it turns out that, where are we? So it turns out that one combination of these becomes a longitudinal part of the Z, and two parts of these become the longitudinal parts of the W plus minus. And again, the story here goes through exactly like in the standard model. And what we're left with from these 8 initial degrees of freedom is now 5 physical Higgs states. So in the standard model, we have one complex doublet, and that's 4 degrees of freedom. And 3 of those degrees of freedom are eaten to make the longitudinal parts of the Z and the W. And that leaves 1 degree of freedom, and that's what we identify as the Higgs boson. Here we have 8 degrees of freedom, and we still eat 3, which leaves us 5 physical degrees of freedom. So instead of just having one Higgs boson, we're going to get a bunch of them. Now, the way to identify those degrees of freedom are, when I do the expansion here, what I'm going to find is that this piece is going to give me something that looks like GVU over 2 times, for example, WVU plus W minus del mu H mu minus, and then a neutral piece, and similar terms here. And the point is that these pieces are going to tell me what linear combination of HU minus and HD minus, for example, get eaten to make the goldstones. So from this, one of the terms I get beyond just the fermion mass terms is going to be this bilinear piece. And this bilinear piece looks like, if you like, W mu turning into a Higgs. And the way we interpret these, in the standard model, you can get rid of this by choice of gauge. It's a bit trickier in this case. But the way you identify these bilinear terms is that whenever you see a bilinear term like this, you identify this as a combination of the goldstone. So if I take a part from here and a part from here, it'll tell me which linear combinations of HU and HD, both neutral and both neutral and charged, to identify as the goldstones. So I won't go through how to actually derive this, but if you just expand this out, you'll be able to see which goldstone modes by looking at which linear combinations coupled to the vector bosons in these bilinear ways. So now, if I take these 8 states and I project out the goldstones, I'm going to get 5 physical degrees of freedom. And these 5 physical degrees of freedom are going to consist of 2 scalars. And when I mean scalars, I mean from the real parts I'm going to have 1 pseudoscalar, and the pseudo part just means from the imaginary parts of the neutral guys. So the imaginary parts of HU0 and HD0, there are obviously 2 of them. One combination is going to correspond to the goldstone mode. So I project that out, and the part that I'm left over with is going to be the physical pseudoscalar. And finally, I have a physical charge take state, H plus minus, and the charge takes part comes from the non-goldstone combination of HU plus and HD minus. So this gives me 5 states, 3 neutral states and 2 charge states, so H plus, H minus. Everything works out. And they're straightforward expressions for the mass matrices of these that you get from expanding out the Higgs potential and plugging in the minimization conditions for the VEBs. So again, this story works out just like the standard model, except with a few complications. So the main complication is that it's a bit harder to identify the Goldstones. But once you do identify the Goldstones, you're left with a set of physical degrees of freedom. These guys have a 2x2 mass matrix. You diagonalize that mass matrix to get their eigenvalues, and the mass matrices here and here just pop out automatically. You don't have to diagonalize anything. Okay, so this gives electroweak symmetry breaking, and we have the rest of the MSSM spectrum coming out in a fairly straightforward way. So electroweak symmetry breaking does a few other things. Remember that for a given, write it this way. For a given fermion, we have a fermion corresponding to a left-handed fermion, and also a fermion corresponding to a right-handed fermion. And this piece corresponds to kind of the FC, the conjugate of the FC star. So for example, we had UC and DC, and their scalar components were the scalar superpartners of the left-handed UC and DC fermions. And the conjugates of UC and DC fermions are U right and D right. So we can identify this thing conjugated with the essentially the superpartner of the right-handed fermion. And these fermions, these left and right-handed fermions, end up mixing after electroweak symmetry breaking. And the origin of this electroweak symmetry breaking mixing comes from partly the A term. So if I look at the A terms up here, if I turn on a Higgs VEV, this will be a bilinear between two scalars, between the left and right-handed states. And there will also be another combination from the superpotential, where, for example, if I take DDQ of the superpotential, this will give me something that looks like HUUC. And there will be a cross term with the other term from the downstate. So in any case, the fermion mass matrices end up looking something like this. I'll just show it in the case of the let's say the up quark. There'll be something like a MQ squared. There'll be a direct contribution from the Higgs VEVs. And then there will be a D-term contribution to the mass. And then there will be another D-term contribution to the mass. And then these off-diagonal pieces will have the following form. They'll look something like AU minus, in this case, So the general form of the fermion mass matrices, so here I'm just showing it for an up-type squark, is you have these diagonal terms. A lot of the diagonal terms come from the soft pieces. There's a piece that corresponds to the standard model mass of the superpartner. And then there's a D-term contribution. And the D-term contributions, D left, right, go roughly like nz squared. And then you also have these off-diagonal terms. So these off-diagonal terms are typically proportional to the mass of the fermion superpartner of this fermion. And then there's a piece that comes from soft breaking and a piece that comes from the superpotential. So this standard model mass is proportional to electroweak symmetry breaking. So the left and right mixing depends on electroweak symmetry breaking. The other thing, though, is that this left-right mixing, because it's proportional to the corresponding standard model superpartner mass, is going to be very small for the first two generations. So a standard thing to do is to ignore for the first two generations, ignore the left-right mixing. And because of this, people often talk about people often talk about left and right-handed, let's say, up squarks, and left and right-handed down squarks. And in principle, there is some mixing between them, but numerically it's very tiny. On the other hand, for the third generation, for MB or MT, you can have a reasonable amount of mixing, even for the tau. So the standard thing to do is to include the mixing for the third generation. And that means that people talk about stop one, stop two, spottom one, spottom two, and even stow one, stow two. And the naming convention, the 1-2, is that the lighter state after the mixing is the one, and the heavier state is a two. So this is the mass the mass ordering convention. So here, for example, for the stop, I can have a fair bit of left-right stop mixing. And that means that one state will be pushed down in mass, the other will be pushed up in mass. And I won't have a direct connection between left and right-handed states. And that means that the lighter states, it's called stop one, heavier states, stop two. So this is the story for the fermions. We also have mixing induced by electric symmetry breaking for the fermionic superpartners. So the fermions are all the scalar superpartners. We also have fermionic superpartners in the form of gauginos plus Higginsinos. So of these, electric symmetry breaking doesn't do anything to the gluino. So we still have a gluino G tilde with mass and gluino essentially given by the soft mass. So there's no contribution to electroweak symmetry breaking for the gluino. But for the electroweak gauginos and electroweak Higginsinos and the electroweak gauginos, electroweak symmetry breaking is going to mix them. And the place you get electroweak symmetry breaking mixing them is stuff like, for example, HU dagger. So because I have terms like this from the supersymmetrization of the gauge couplings, so this is one example of such a term. This thing, after I put in the Higgs bev, is going to give me something that looks like 1 root 2 G VU, and then a mixing between the Wino, the gauginos of the SE2 left doublet, the SE2 left adjoint with the up Higginsino, and then I'll have something similar for the down Higginsino. And the upshot of this is this gives me gauginos Higginsino mixing that is proportional to this thing, which is going to go like, in this case, MW sine beta. And then if I had the corresponding term with HD, I would have a cos beta. And I could also have a similar mixing with a Bino through hypercharge, through the corresponding hypercharge G prime piece. So the upshot of this is that I get all kinds of mixing. I get mixing between both neutral and neutral and charged states independently. So in total, my superpartners of the Higginsinos to give me four neutralinos. So the neutralinos are the mass eigenstates I get after mixing all these guys. And we usually write this as chi0i with, again, mi less than or equal to mi plus 1. And this mixing for the neutral states gives me four neutral neutralinos, as their name suggests. And then finally, okay, and then I should say that these are all Majorana fermions. And I also have charge states mixing, HU plus, HD minus, so I also have two direct so-called charge enos, which I write as chi I plus minus, again, mi less than or equal to mi plus 1. And here I goes from 1 to 2, and here I equals 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so this is the whole MSSM spectrum. Again, we started off with a fairly straightforward superpotential plus R parity plus soft terms. We go through, we find electroweak symmetry breaking. Electroweak symmetry breaking is arranged to reproduce the right Higgs bev such that we get the right W and Z masses. Once we have that, we go off and compute the rest of the spectrum. And the rest of the spectrum consists of these five physical Higgs states, the massive W and Z vector bosons, a massless photon, massless gluon. We have all the fermion superpartners. These are the scalar superpartners of the standard model fermions. And then we have these mixtures of the gauge enos and the Higgs enos. So we have the gluino sitting on its own. And we have, through electroweak symmetry breaking, mixing between the neutral and charged electroweak fermion superpartners to give me four Majorana neutralinos and two Dirac charge enos. So this is the whole MSSM. And there's one other piece that I'm going to talk about a little bit more down the road, and that is the gravitino. So if you recall with the standard model, we had the standard model, and in a sense, we fairly trivially extended it to include gravity by just taking the usual Einstein-Hilbert action, expanding around some, let's say, flat space-time background, and then identifying the fluctuations around that background as spin two gravitons. And we could write down a low energy effective theory for those spin two gravitons. And there's our low energy effective quantum theory of gravity coupled to the standard model. So that works well. In principle, we could also do this with supersymmetry. And when you do that with supersymmetry, you have to embed the you have to also embed the spin two graviton into a supermultiplet. And that supermultiplet turns out to give a superpartner to the graviton with spin 3/2 gravitino. I'll write as G tilde. So I'm just mentioning it now in passing. I'll come back to it and talk more about it when I get to supersymmetry breaking. But we'll see that in some cases, this gravitino can also be interesting and important for studying the phenomenology of the theory, to study the signals of the theory, both for cosmology and at particle colliders like the LHC. Okay. So, yes.
Does the MSSM help the instability of the Higgs vacuum that people talk about in the standard model courses?
So actually, that's a good point. I'll just do a quick aside for that. Okay, so this is a quick aside for Tibrick's question. So in the standard model, recall that I have a Higgs potential that looks like that. And this Higgs potential, so V, and then here is H, and the Higgs potential looks like that. And it seems like as I go off to very, very large values of the Higgs field, this potential just keeps on going up and up and up and up and up. Now, it turns out that that's not quite the case in the standard model, because the appropriate value of lambda I should use is in fact a running value of lambda evaluated at the scale on the order of the Higgs bev. So this coupling, I can think of it as changing its effective value as I measure it at different energies. So you saw this either on the homework or in one of the tutorials, and I think you saw the standard model a fair bit. So this is very important for the gauge coupling for SU3 color. And we'll talk a little bit more about that either later today or tomorrow. But the point is that this coupling has a dependence on energy. And the appropriate thing when I talk about the potential is I should use this, I should use the running value of the coupling as I go out far off in field space. And the running value of this coupling, it turns out it's initially positive. It has to be positive initially, or else I don't stabilize my Higgs potential. But there are big corrections to this from gauge couplings, also the Toppukawa, but the gauge couplings end up being important as you go far out. And it turns out that in a standard model, this quartic coupling actually goes from positive to negative. So if I was to draw the running value of this lambda of h, it starts off positive, but it ends up decreasing as they go along in energy. And eventually, it turns out that this coupling goes negative. And when this coupling goes negative, I no longer stabilize my potential. And what happens is that as the coupling becomes smaller and smaller, my potential actually turns over. And as it goes negative, I actually start going down again. And as far as we can tell, at least within the standard model alone, and I follow its evolution through the renormalization group, this thing turns over and just keeps on falling and falling and falling. So the picture of the standard model that seems to come out of this is that we live here. This is good. But that if you go way, way out in field space, and by way, way out, remember, this is of order kind of 100 GeV, the place where it turns over is more like 10 to the 11 GeV or so. And you can compute where it turns over based on the measure value of the top mass and the measure value of the strong coupling and the other couplings in the standard model. And the picture for the standard model that seems to come out, if I don't extend the standard model with anything else, if I just take the strict standard model, is that now my potential just keeps on falling off and off. And in principle, I could tunnel from here up to here. And people have computed this turnover. And they've also computed the tunneling rate from here to here. And they find that the tunneling rate is, fortunately, much, much longer than the age of the universe for the measured value of the top mass. But it's actually a pretty close thing. If the top mass was something like 2 GeV lower, the tunneling rate from here out to here would actually be faster than the age of the universe. And we'd have some kind of serious problem, or at least a serious problem with our understanding of the standard model. As it stands, the top mass seems to be just big enough that the tunneling rate is long enough that we don't actually have to worry about tunneling to this other vacuum where things are totally different, but life is OK. Now, this picture only applies within the standard model. And sometimes this is also referred to as the Higgs instability problem. It's independent from the gauge hierarchy problem, which sometimes is also called a stability problem, but it's a completely different stability problem. But what's going on here? So we're OK if we live here. But there are certain puzzles. So one thing that can happen, and one thing that people worry about, is suppose you had a very hot early universe where maybe you start off way over here, or maybe you have inflation, and maybe inflation pushes you out over here rather than over here. And this is still an open question, what inflation does, or what these cross-couplings do, or what happens at very high temperatures. But it is at least worrisome that the Higgs potential is turning over like this. So it may not actually be a problem, but it is something that keeps people up at night. Now, if I extend the standard model with other stuff, this picture for the quartic ends up being different. So for example, what happens in the MSSM is that I don't have this turnover. And I don't have this turnover precisely because my effective quartic is related to the gauge couplings. And specifically, my effective quartic comes in as the square of these gauge couplings. So I don't have to worry about the sign of the gauge couplings. The sign of the gauge couplings actually, in some sense, isn't physical. But in the MSSM, I don't have this turnover at all. So a nice feature of the MSSM, beyond just giving an explanation for why the Higgs mass scale is as small as it is, it also tells us that we don't have to worry about this Higgs instability problem. So this may or may not actually be a problem, but it is at least a bit of a slightly disconcerting thing in the standard model. Okay, so that was a quick aside, not really related to supersymmetry, but it is an interesting story, and yeah, thanks for bringing it up, because it's something you might hear about, and it's something it doesn't hurt to have an idea of what's going on. Okay, so let me... let me go back, and what I want to talk about now is models for the Suzy Brakeman. And the point is that in the MSSM, I wrote down a bunch of soft terms. And from the point of view of the MSSM, these soft terms are an explicit breaking of supersymmetry. So I'm just taking my Lagrangian that has supersymmetry, that's symmetric under supersymmetry, and I'm adding to that Lagrangian a bunch of terms that don't respect supersymmetry. But ultimately, we kind of expect that supersymmetry, if it's around, should be some fairly fundamental thing. And if it's some fairly fundamental thing, you don't actually want to break it explicitly. Instead, you expect that it should be broken spontaneously. And that's where models for supersymmetry breaking come in. So one comment, one thing for supersymmetry breaking is that, I guess in the homework and some of the tutorials, you've seen some cases of supersymmetry breaking, where you end up getting this massless Golestino state. And when you have spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, you also end up splitting masses and masses of superpartners. Now, there's some interesting general features for supersymmetry breaking. One thing you might hope to do initially is, could I start off by writing down an MSSM, and within the MSSM itself, could I arrange for supersymmetry breaking to occur just using those MSSM fields? And it turns out that doesn't work. I'll get to why it doesn't work in a second. The other thing I wanted to mention is that you can show, based on the supersymmetry algebra, that I can write the expectation value of the Hamiltonian of the theory, which is related to the supersymmetry generators through the supersymmetry algebra, or superalgebra. I can write this as 0 of Q1, Q1 bar, plus Q1 bar, Q1, plus Q2, Q2 bar, plus Q2 bar, Q1. So I can relate this to the anti-commutator of Q with Q bar. And remember, the anti-commutator of Q with Q bar looks something like sigma mu p mu. If I sandwich this between the vacuum state, the spatial components of p mu vanish, because we assume the vacuum doesn't have any spatial momentum, but it can have a net energy. So that gives me the zero component. So I take this, and I can rewrite this just using orthogonality and so on as Q1 bar 0 plus Q1 0 plus one plus the two pieces. So the upshot of all this is that this thing is manifestly non-negative. I can write this expectation value, the vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian, as something that is definitely non-negative. But the other thing is that if I look at these generators, for supersymmetry to be a preserved symmetry, so with no spontaneous breaking, that means that the vacuum should be invariant under supersymmetry transformations. And that that means that Q alpha is 0, 0. That means that if I preserve supersymmetry as an exact unbroken symmetry, the supersymmetry generators should annihilate the vacuum. So this is the standard condition for preserving a symmetry explicitly. But on the other hand, if I had spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, my theory, my underlying Lagrangian will still be supersymmetric. But the only difference is now my vacuum state would select off some state that isn't supersymmetric. So this is what we see with just regular symmetry breaking. That even though let's say you have your lambda, your abelian Higgs model or none or just some kind of sigma model, your Lagrangian is symmetric, but your vacuum state selects at a certain point that isn't invariant under the symmetry. So the same thing happens here. So with spontaneously broken, we have Q alpha 0 not equal to 0 for at least some alpha. And the upshot of that is that if any of these terms is non-zero, then because of this structure in here for the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, it will only give a positive contribution to the vacuum energy. So spontaneous broken corresponds to the vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian greater than 0. And if you recall, the vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian corresponds to the vacuum expectation value of the scalar potential, which corresponds to Vf plus Vd, which I can write as some I Fi squared plus one half dA squared. So what we see from this whole business is that supersymmetry breaking, if it occurs, tells me that my vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian is positive. And because I can write my vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian as the vacuum expectation value of the scalar potential, and the scalar potential takes this positive definite form, f squared plus d squared, the upshot of all this is if I have spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, the way it's going to come about is I'm going to see it in terms of having, sorry if you can't see this, the way it's going to appear is as a non-zero value of either an F term or a D term. So this is just a result of the structure of the vacuum potential plus the supersymmetry algebra. And we're going to use this to identify supersymmetry breaking. And in fact, you can parameterize the amount of supersymmetry breaking by the size of the F or D terms in the theory. And for example, if I was to go back and look at my MSSM, my MSSM is now, I spontaneously broken supersymmetry, but I've broken it by soft terms. And if you go off and you compute F terms in the MSSM, you'll see that they have vacuum expectation values as a result of the Higgs vacuum expectation values. And the size of those vacuum expectation values are set by this Higgs potential, which is set by the soft terms, which tells me that in the MSSM, the effective F terms you generate are set by the soft terms. So this shouldn't be too surprising. On the other hand, what we're interested in here is a theory in which we don't explicitly break supersymmetry to give us non-zero F terms. We want to get these F terms from just minimizing a supersymmetric potential itself. So we'll get to that in a second. There's one other general feature of supersymmetry breaking. I'll write it over here. And you should have you've already encountered this, is that if I spontaneously break supersymmetry, I still preserve a quantity called the supertrace. So the supertrace, I can think of this as an operation on the mass matrix for all the particles in the theory. And this is defined to be the sum over all the bosons times gb mb squared minus sum over all the fermions gf mf squared. And it's equal to 0 if my theory is either supersymmetric or it's supersymmetric up to spontaneous breaking. If I have explicit supersymmetry breaking, the supertrace will be non-zero. And this GB and GF correspond to the number of degrees, the number of real degrees of freedom of the either boson or the fermion. So here B is boson, F is fermion. It's obvious that in an unbroken supersymmetric theory, where all my bosons and fermions have the same mass and the same numbers of degrees of freedom, this automatically cancels. But it turns out that in a spontaneously broken supersymmetric theory, even though I might split the mass of the bosons and the fermions, the splitting is such that the supertrace still vanishes. So now, suppose I was to try to break supersymmetry spontaneously with only the standard model superpotential and not including any of the soft terms. The problem I'd run into is that I still have to satisfy the supertrace relation. And the upshot of this is that if I took the sum of all the standard model masses weighted by their degrees of freedom, this would have to match up in a sense to the sum of all the superpartner masses weighted by their degrees of freedom. And the sum of standard model masses isn't all that big. Essentially, the only things that will contribute are the top quark, the Higgs, and the W and Z bosons. The other stuff is essentially ignorable. And if that was a whole story, that would tell me that my superpartners, the sum of all my superpartner masses, would have to be less than a few hundred GeV squared. And we know experimentally that we haven't seen superpartners that light. So because of the supertrace relation, it's just not possible phenomenologically to break supersymmetry spontaneously within the MSSM alone. So instead, we have a different picture. Our different picture for spontaneous supersymmetry breaking in the MSSM and beyond is that we have some MSSM sector. Sometimes we call this a visible sector. So we live here, plus superpartners. And we have a so-called hidden sector. And the hidden sector is where supersymmetry breaking happens. And because of this supertrace relation, the supersymmetry breaking, in a sense, is kind of messy. So the picture we have for supersymmetry breaking, we assume that it occurs spontaneously in a hidden sector. And then there's some connection to the visible sector, the MSSM sector, through a set of particles that connect them called messengers. And the story here is that you have some supersymmetry breaking here. You assume it's spontaneous. It gets transmitted to the MSSM. But now the typical assumption is that this hidden sector stuff is pretty heavy. So to write down a low energy effective theory, what you do is you take the hidden sector stuff plus the messenger stuff, you integrate it out. And when you integrate it out, what you'll see in your low energy effective theory is something that looks like an explicit breaking in the MSSM. So our understanding of the MSSM soft terms, or the expectation for the MSSM soft terms, is a story like this. There's some new hidden sector, there's some messengers, and there's the MSSM. And the general structure of theories of supersymmetry breaking, you typically specify a hidden sector, you specify the messengers, and this will tell you what the soft terms are. And the soft terms we'll see, or the soft terms, as we've seen, largely dictate the spectrum of superpartner masses in the MSSM. And we can run this backwards. So one of the reasons why finding supersymmetry would be really exciting, beyond just finding supersymmetry and all these new particles, is that we would also get some indirect information about new physics that could potentially be very heavy, and possibly even quantum gravity. So the idea is that if you were to measure the superpartner masses in the MSSM, we could figure out what these soft terms look like. And these soft terms would tell us about the messenger mechanism and possibly even the supersymmetry breaking mechanism. So just to give you a quick overview, the standard assumption is that the supersymmetry breaking in the hidden sector is dominated by a non-zero F term. So recall that we need a non-zero F term or non-zero D term for supersymmetry breaking. It turns out that if we only had D term breaking, we wouldn't get Gay-Jinot masses. So we need F term breaking for Gay-Jinot masses and the standard assumption is that the hidden sector breaking is dominated by an F term. So this is our hidden sector Susi breaking. And we assume further that there's some typical mass scale. And this is usually a messenger mass scale. And it's very heavy. And then there's some dimensionless coupling that I'll call C star that corresponds to the messenger effective coupling. And given these assumptions, that there's some hidden sector spontaneous supersymmetry breaking parameterized by an F term, there's some mass scale associated with the messengers, and there's some effective messenger coupling between here and here. What you get at the end of the day, and we'll see this explicitly in some examples, is that the soft scale for the MSSM superpartners goes like C star times F over M star. And this has all the right properties in the sense that the soft terms are proportional to the amount of hidden sector supersymmetry breaking. In this case, we're assuming it's spontaneous. The soft terms should go to zero as I decouple the messengers. And I can decouple the messengers either by making them infinitely heavy or by making the effective coupling very small. So this has the right property for that. The other thing is recall that F terms have mass dimension 2. So dimensionally, this also works out. So this, based on dimensional analysis and these general arguments corresponding to the symmetries, has the right structure. And we'll see it realized in explicit models tomorrow. So tomorrow, I plan to finish up supersymmetry and then move on to other extensions of the standard model based on new forces and strong coupling.